Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 905. Globalization, transnational corporations, and Japanese fascism. This is being recorded on May 8th of the year 2016. For veteran and knowledgeable listeners, this program will be largely review. However, I thought that in light of a couple of things, one, the predominance of discussion about the transnational corporate link to fascism, focusing primarily on Germany and Europe, I thought that recapping some of the information about links between transnational corporations, American in particular, and globalization, specifically the investment of U.S. profits from the 1920s boom of the Roaring Twenties abroad under the Webb-Pomeroy Act. I thought that reviewing how, again, globalization, the maneuvering of and or by transnational corporations, and the rise of Japanese fascism, its ravages during World War II, and its reinstitution following the end of World War II, albeit behind a relatively benign, even cheerful-looking facade, would be in order. As the 2016 presidential race gathers momentum with Donald Trump looking like the Republican nominee and Hillary Clinton the Democratic nominee, there has been a lot of discussion of globalization, trade acts, understandably so, or trade agreements, understandably so, and how they have impacted not only the American economy, but the American labor market and the fortunes of American workers in particular. In the books for download section of the SpitfireList.com website, there is an introduction to the anti-fascist books that are there, and it talks about how globalization really was the driving force behind the rise of fascism. I'm going to read a portion of that right now. In the decades since the end of the Second World War, much has been written about that war and fascism, the driving force behind the aggression that precipitated the conflict. Unfortunately, much of what has been said and written has failed to identify and analyze the causes, nature, and methodology of fascism, German National Socialism, or Nazism in particular. A deeper, more accurate analysis was presented in literature published before, during, and immediately after World War II. And some of these books are available for download for free on the Spitfire website. Skipping down. Some of the books presented here illustrate the extent to which fascism, Nazism in particular, was an outgrowth of globalization and the construction of international monopolies or cartels. Key to understanding this phenomenon is analysis of the Webb-Pomeroy Act legislated near the end of the First World War. A loophole in the antitrust legislation of 1914, it effectively legalized the formation of cartels, international monopolies, for firms that were barred from domestic monopolistic practices. Decrying what they viewed as excessive and restrictive, quote, regulation, unquote, here in the United States, U.S.-based transnational corporations invested their profits from the industrial boom of the 1920s abroad, primarily in Japan and Germany. This process might well be viewed as the real beginning of what is now known as globalization. And there are a number of programs that talk about this that you can listen to and the descriptions to which you can read. These programs present an overview of the reinvestment of the wealth generated by the American industrial boom of the 1920s in German and Japanese strategic heavy industry. It was this capital that drove the engines of conquest and subdued both Europe and Asia during the conflict. We also note that the failure of American industrial and financial firms to invest their capital in U.S. infrastructure contributed significantly to the onset of the Great Depression, depriving American industry of the monies needed to sustain the engines of industry and commerce. At the conclusion of World War II, industrialists, financiers, and associated luminaries formed the World Commerce Corporation, explicitly designed to replace the German-based cartels that coalesced after World War I. The WCCC directed the post-war flow of wealth into channels favored by the global corporate elite, thus preserving the fundamental economic order that was established in previous decades via the Webb-Pomeroy Act. Again, the engines of conquest that surged all over Europe and Asia were basically the transmogrified, reinvested profits from the U.S. heavy industrial boom of the 1920s, which instead of being reinvested in the U.S. economy, were invested abroad, primarily in Japan and Germany. And in turn, those countries invested that money in strategic heavy industry and used it to conquer Europe and Asia. We're going to begin with an excerpt from Miscellaneous Archive Show number 26, recorded on October 2nd of 1988.
First of all, concerning the rise of fascism in Japan, we're going to take a look very briefly at the overleaf in a book that describes in considerable detail the assassination program which systematically eliminated the responsible democratic political leadership in Japan and replaced it with fascists and militarists. The book we're going to borrow on very briefly now is called Government by Assassination. It's authored by Hugh Bias, B-Y-A-S, formerly the Tokyo correspondent for the New York Times. The book was published in hardcover, copyright 1942 by Alfred A. Knopf and Company in New York. And on the overleaf, there is a good summary of the book itself. The book itself is far too long for us to excerpt in the amount of time that we have this evening, so we're going to take a look at the overleaf, which provides a good, accurate summary of just what this book is about for the most part. Here is the truth about the patriotic murder societies, the army gangsters, the army's idea of Japan's destiny, and the strange role of the emperor. Basically, what this book, before I continue to read the overleaf, what this book describes is the assassination program which brought Japanese fascism to power. This was executed by the so-called patriotic societies, which in considerable measure were both religious organizations and, at a street level, organized crime syndicates. The patriotic societies, notably the Black Dragon Society, headed up by Mitsuru Toyama, were the focus of a good portion of our discussion in Radio Free America program number 7, dealing with cults. These organizations, which again at one level were actually sort of religious in nature, at the street level they functioned in a very practical way as organized crime syndicates, with all that implies, were functioning at the behest of the Japanese Imperial National Security Establishment as assassins and hommes de main. Continuing with the overleaf to Hugh Bias' book. In Japan, the army possesses a kind of autonomy which immunizes it from control by any other agency. Long ago, Mr. Bias saw that the intoxication of this immunity would lead to war, and so he spent many years ferreting out from the secretive Japanese how the militarists gained their fantastic power. His book, therefore, is to Japan what Rauschning's Revolution of Nihilism was to Germany. Starting from the grassroots of Japanese politics, it moves steadily toward the amazing disclosure of principles. At bottom, the Japanese army is closely allied with gangsterism. The so-called patriotic societies which do its dirty work are nothing more than leagues of murderers, blackmailers, and thieves. Bias shows how these terrorists made contact years ago with certain groups of appreciative younger officers, and how consequently, almost every civilian leader who curbed the army's power was assassinated. This, of course, has two haunting parallels. First of all, as we looked at in Radio Free America program number 10, the rise of fascism in Germany was paved by the assassination program of the so-called Freikorps, or the Black Reichswehr. Basically, underground German army organizations, the Reichswehr, the Einwohnerwehr, and the Zeitfreiwilligenverbande, collectively known as the Black Reichswehr, originally put together as formal extensions of the Reichswehr, the German army, which then survived illegally to function autonomously, I should say, as extensions of the will of the German General Staff, systematically assassinated the legitimate democratic leadership of Weimar Germany. People like Foreign Minister von Rathenau, Matthias Erzberger, Kurt Eisner, Gustav Landauer, Karl Gereiss, and others, names that should have gone down in history, have been largely obscured because they were dispatched by the so-called Black Reichswehr. The most unnerving parallel is to contemporary America, where even as so-called progressives sit wringing their hands about the fact that we don't have any legitimate political leadership, and maybe we'll have to vote for the Peace and Freedom Party because they don't find Mike Dukakis doctrinaire enough. The fact of the matter is we don't have good leaders because they were all blown away in the 60s and 1970s. We no longer have people like John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and others, because they were assassinated by the U.S. national security establishment. Tragically, even though this is a matter of public record, it is a public record that the American people have steadfastly refused to look at, to their own eventual demise, no doubt. Suffice it to say that assassination is endemic to the rise of fascism. It was in Japan, it was in Germany, and regrettably it is here in America. Now, the Japanese army and the patriotic societies, those religious-slash-criminal organizations, in turn were acting at the behest of the dominant interests in Imperial Japan. Those dominant interests were known as the Zaibatsu, Z-A-I-B-A-T-S-U. Those are the five giant family trusts which ran, for all practical purposes, all of Japan. We're going to take a look now at Japanese fascism, in particular its financial and industrial structure. We're going to take a look at what the Zaibatsu are, how they came to power in a sense, or how they wield their power. We're going to take a look at their connections with American capital, and we're going to take a look at Emperor Hirohito's involvement with the Zaibatsu. And for our information, we're going to rely on a fabulous book, one we've used in the past. That book is called Facts and Fascism. It was copyrighted in 1943, published in hardcover by In Fact Incorporated. The author is a man who is regarded widely as the dean of American investigative journalism. His name is George Seldes, S-E-L-D-E-S. By the way, Seldes' autobiography, Witness to a Century, is a currently available book for people who would like to find out more about him. Again, we've used this book many times in the past, and we are now going to rely on it for our discussion of the structure and evolution of Japanese fascism. Seldes writes in Facts and Fascism in a chapter called The Five Who Own Japan as follows. Fascism, as any study of Hitler Germany shows, has been built up as a system of super colossal robber barons, thanks largely to the international cartels of which IG Farben Industry was the largest. Interrupting that, of course, is the giant German chemical trust, the German dyestuffs industry, which we've looked at many times in the past. Continuing. By the way, Uncle Sam and the Swastika and the first two Radio Free America shows go into IG Farben at great length. Continuing. Nationally, all forms of fascism have flourished thanks to the aid the state has given them in maintaining monopolies or trusts. In every instance where businessmen subsidized a reactionary party, whether it was the Fiat works in Italy paying Mussolini, or a landed estate owner bribing a Romanian premier, the party and the most powerful few of the subsidizers have always engaged in forming national monopolies when they took over the rule of the country. Professor Brady, by the way, that's Professor Robert A. Brady, who's a specialist on the economics of fascism in Japan in particular. Professor Robert A. Brady is the only economist who has related the peak associations, or Spitzenverbände, as they were known in Germany, that is, the biggest trade associations, such as the NAM, that's National Association of Manufacturers, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, with the subsidization of fascist movements, and shown how business, whether or not it is officially on the throne, has in all countries become a political power, in fact, the ruling power behind the thrones of fascism. Repeating that sentence again. Professor Brady is the only economist who has related the peak associations, unquote, or Spitzenverbände, as they were known in Germany, that is, the biggest trade associations, such as the NAM and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, with the subsidization of fascist movements and shown how business, whether or not it is officially on the throne, has in all countries become a political power, in fact, the ruling power behind the thrones of fascism. In Japan, the peak associations, unquote, are dominated by the Zaibatsu, or four ruling families, who are comparatively more powerful and richer than the 13 ruling families of America. Excuse me, there are only four Zaibatsu. The fifth power here is the emperor, I was misinterpreting the title here. There are only four Zaibatsu, and as we're going to see, they're names that are should be very familiar to a contemporary American. Of the Zaibatsu specifically, Seldes writes, Japan's financial oligarchy, wrote Anthony Jenkinson for the Institute of Pacific Relations, is composed of great family trusts known as Zaibatsu. Its leading members are the houses of Mitsui, Mitsubishi, Sumitomo, and Yasuda. Between them, they own the greater part of industry, trade, banking, and shipping. By 1937, they controlled more than one-third of the total deposits in private banks, 70% of the deposits in all trust companies, and one-third of total foreign trade. By controlling the banks, they controlled the smaller credit institutions throughout the country, unquote. Again, the names of the four Zaibatsu, in effect the fifth Zaibatsu being Emperor Hirohito himself, as we shall see. The four Zaibatsu are the houses of Mitsui, Mitsubishi, Sumitomo, and Yasuda. Continuing with Seldes' account, in 1937, the government brought all the leading employers and business confederations together in the Japanese League of Economic Organizations, which Professor Brady describes as a sort of private national defense council for business enterprise. He concludes, quote, It would be hard to imagine a much higher degree of policy-determining power than is indicated by the combination of the Zaibatsu and its concentric cartel and federational machinery. The hierarchy of business control seems well nigh complete, unquote. The government of Japan and the business interests of Japan are bound together, quote, from center to circumference, unquote. What is being accomplished is the gradual rounding out of a highly coordinated fascist type of totalitarian economy. Professor Brady points out the fact that it was because the old system of feudalism prevailed longer in Japan than elsewhere that, quote, The new Japanese totalitarianism has been easier to achieve than in any other major industrial capitalistic country, unquote. The feudal and patriarchal-minded hierarchies of business, unquote, and the political and military bureaucracies were identified and centralized. Government and business are more intermarried in Japan than anywhere else, much more so than in the ruling family of Goering, Hitler and company. But all in all, the fascist pattern is pretty much the same in all countries where wealth and power have taken over the military, economic, political rule. Professor Brady writes that in Japan, the elements, quote, are not greatly dissimilar to those noted for other totalitarian systems of the general fascist type, unquote. He lists, 1. The Zaibatsu, the monopolistically oriented enterprises centered around them, and the extensive network of trade associations, chambers of commerce, cartels, and similar bodies of which they are the acknowledged leaders, constitute an elaborate, semi-legal hierarchy of graduated economic power. 2. The hierarchy works very closely with the civil and administrative bureaucracy of the state. This constitutes the Japanese version of National Socialism. 3. The military is becoming increasingly part and parcel of the same control pyramid. 4. And finally, the psychopathic ideological propaganda cement which holds the Kakutai, the K-O-K-U-T-A-I, corporate state amalgam together in the fused power of Shinto, the main religion, and Bushido, precepts of knighthood. That last sentence again, and by the way, I may know how to pronounce the Emperor of Japan's name really correctly, but some of these names may be wrong. I don't speak Japan, I've just seen that reference in some other books I have. Again, the last item. And this, by the way, should be related very directly to the article we read earlier concerning the impending death of Emperor Hirohito and its political significance for the possible resurgence of Japanese nationalism and fascism. And finally, the psychopathic ideological propaganda cement, which holds the Kokutai, a corporate state amalgam together in the fused power of Shinto, the main religion, and Bushido, precepts of knighthood. Next, we're going to take a look at Seldes' discussion not only of Emperor Hirohito's direct connections to the Zaibatsu, he being actually the main beneficiary of the Zaibatsu, but we're also going to take a look at the Zaibatsu's international connections, their connections to the international munitions cartels, and perhaps most significantly for our purposes, their connections to big American capital. Every Japanese gun, bullet, torpedo, ship, and airplane that has killed or wounded an American soldier, sailor, airman, or marine has meant actual cash money in the pocket of Emperor Hirohito. when the merchants of death, unquote, the armaments manufacturers who had a financial interest in waging previous wars and who still do in fascist dictatorships were exposed in 1934, it was found that Mitsui and Mitsubishi were the Japanese members of the cartel and that the reigning family was a large stockholder in both. Hidashito owns 3,800,000 acres of land with all the buildings on them, many being tenements from which he makes a rent. The total value when the yen was still 50 cents was estimated at 6,637,234,000 yen. The son of the sun goddess has also invested 300 million yen in the Bank of Japan, the South Manchuria Railroad, the Yokohama Specie Bank, Nippon Yusen Kaisha, the shipping line of the Mitsubishi firm, the Imperial Hotel of Tokyo, and the Mitsui and Mitsubishi Enterprises. Next here, Seldes goes on to discuss Japanese participation in the international munitions cartels. Those cartels were front and center in the Nye Committee hearings that were presided over by Alger Hiss, chief counsel to the Nye Committee, and which were inspired in considerable measure by a book called The Merchants of Death, which is undoubtedly the reference in which we saw in this earlier paragraph where, although he doesn't have Merchants of Death capitalized, he has it in quotes. The book is called The Merchants of Death. You can still find it. I've forgotten the author's name offhand. This book inspired to a considerable extent the Nye Committee, and Alger Hiss made a great deal of political hay by distributing this to people. What that book basically pointed out is that in considerable measure the wars of this century and of the late 19th century have been spurred on by giant international munitions cartels which have a profound influence in all of the countries on both sides of all of these wars, or all of this world's major wars in the last 100 years or so. Of the Japanese connections to the international munitions cartels, Seldes writes as follows. In the wave of disillusionment which swept over the world after the Treaty of Versailles and proved that the old march of the imperialists would be resumed and that all international idealism, Woodrow Wilson's for example, would be destroyed, many secrets were uncovered, and one of the most sensational was that concerning the International of Blood, the cartels of the merchants of death, the armaments makers who made a profit on the guns, the shells, and the bullets. The manufacturing corporations in many instances were found linked to governments and to have arranged, even in wartime, for the continuance of their dividends and distribution of their profits. There were several hundred members of the cartels, but only 50 were powerful, and of these, the handful which influenced world events and formed the Harvey United Steel Company cartel, the Nobel Dynamite Trust, the various rifle, gunpowder, and similar cartels were Krupp in Germany, Vickers Armstrong in Britain, Schneider Creusot in France, Škoda in Austria-Hungary, Cerny Ansaldo in Italy, Mitsui in Japan, and the Bethlehem Steel Company and DuPont Empire in the United States. Charles M. Schwab's Bethlehem held 4,301 shares in the Harvey cartel. Albert Vickers was chairman. It should be noted here that just as American big business was found at the time of the First World War to be linked to Japanese big business through the Harvey cartel, Nobel International Trust and other... let me read that again. It should be noted here that just as American big business was found at the time of the First World War to be linked to Japanese big business through the Harvey cartel, Nobel International Trust, and other agencies, so just before the outbreak of the global war, World War II, it was discovered that the international of money was even stronger than ever. One of the links was the IG Farben industry, which Hitler and Goering controlled and which involved Standard Oil, Standard Drug, General Motors, and General Electric and other of our greater corporations. Interrupting, of course, again, the international cartel connections of American big business with that of Nazi Germany were the main focus of Uncle Sam and the Swastika, an archive show available from Archives on Audio, and also were gone into in considerable measure in Radio Free America shows 2, 1, and 2, and also were touched on in a big way in Radio Free America number 10. Resuming Seldes' account, and here he goes into the international cartel connections linking American big business with the Japanese Zaibatsu. Just as American big business was linked to Japan through the Harvey Combine, steel, the Nobel Dynamite Trust, munitions, and the other munitions cartels before the last war, so before the global war, or World War II, there were the usual international cartels in which both the U.S. and Japan shared with Germany, Italy, and other nations. In addition, according to the San Francisco journalist John Pittman, quote, among the owners of Japanese business are International General Electric, which operates plants through its subsidiary, Tokyo Shibaura, Westinghouse Electric International, associated with Mitsubishi Electric Manufacturing Company, Tidewater Associated Oil, handled by Mitsubishi, Libby Owens Ford, represented by the Nippon Plate Glass Company, Standard Oil, with a known direct investment of $5 million, exclusive of frozen credits and oil in storage, Ford and General Motors, with approximately $10 million sunk in Japan proper, Eastman Kodak, and Singer Sewing Machine, with big organizations in the Japanese Empire, United Engineering and Foundry Company, holding a large stake in Shibaura United Engineering Company. Besides these shares in the industry of Japan proper, American capital is heavily invested in Manchukuo and other exploitation companies of a Japanese origin scattered throughout the Far East. Bear in mind, too, that we're talking about 1943, when the dollar was worth many times what it's worth today. The point being here, obviously, that we have a similar situation in many respects to the kinds of international capital and cartel relations which pertain between the United States and Nazi Germany. The same capital relations applied to the relationships between American big business and the Zaibatsu in Japan. It should be noted, too, that to this day there are significant international capital relations between the U.S. and Japan. One of the things that I've always found pretty ironic about the bellyaching concerning the Japanese inroads into the American automobile market is that the major American auto manufacturers have key investments in the Japanese auto industry. Ford owns a controlling interest in Mazda, for example, and many other American auto manufacturers have major investments in the very companies that are putting American auto workers out of business, and that's something that should be borne in mind. That, again, it's a brief account, but that'll give us some idea of just what Japanese fascism was all about.
That again, from Miscellaneous Archive Show M26, recorded on October 2nd of 1988. The books From Government by Assassination by Hugh Bias, published in 1942, and Facts and Fascism by George Sogies from 1943. Now we're going to listen to an excerpt of For the Record program number 426, recorded on September 29th of 2003.
This book is a remarkable volume called The Yamato Dynasty, authored by Sterling Seagrave and Peggy Seagrave. It's published by Broadway Books, copyright 1999 in hardcover, and the ISBN number is 0-7679-0496-6. This book, by the way, serves as a remarkable foundation for a very important book, perhaps even more important, that has just been issued. That book is called Gold Warriors, also by Peggy and Sterling Seagrave. This book is just out in hardcover by Verso, and very soon I will be doing a broadcast interview with Sterling and Peggy Seagrave, the authors of Yamato Dynasty and the newly released and consummately important Gold Warriors. Now, about the key politicians and military people, chiefly U.S. Ambassador to Japan Joseph Grew, or former U.S. Ambassador to Japan Joseph Grew, Herbert Hoover, Douglas MacArthur, also, as we saw in RFA number 10, closely affiliated with the Morgan interests, and in turn, their deliberate reinstitution of the corporations and the family trust, the Zaibatsu, that had been responsible for the elevation of Japanese fascism and the prosecution of war by the empire, we read as follows in the Yamato Dynasty. By the way, the key names Herbert Hoover, Joseph Grew, and Douglas MacArthur, as we saw. Also, William Draper and the Draper-Johnston Commission. William Draper was associated with Dylan Reed. That is closely affiliated with the Morgan Group. And as we looked at in a number of programs, including a Miscellaneous Archive Show M11, and also some of our discussions, FTR number 199, William Draper was closely associated with a Dylan Reed subsidiary that helped to finance Nazi Germany, and basically was responsible for channeling American investment capital to pre-Nazi and Nazi Germany. After the war, William Draper was in charge of the economic reconstruction of Germany and did his best to try to reinstitute the very same elements, and that effort was successful. His son, by the way, William Draper Jr., William Draper III, became director of Reagan's Export-Import Bank, helped to finance the business ventures of the younger George Bush, and his son, Timothy Draper, helped to finance the school voucher initiative here in California and is now backing Arnold Schwarzenegger for governor as I speak on 9/29/2003. FEC 230 here is the Far Eastern Commission, the State Department commission that was dealing with Japan, and their directive for the decartelization of Japan and the prosecution of the militarists, as well as some of the businessmen who had helped to finance the Japanese criminal war effort. And SCAP is the Supreme Commander Allied Powers, basically the American military government that was in charge of Japan. Of the reinstitution of the fascist elements that had directed Japan by their American counterparts and their homme de main in both Japan and Washington, we read as follows in Sterling and Peggy Seagrave's The Yamato Dynasty. Imprudently, the American bureaucrats who drafted FEC 230 foolishly overlooked the vested interests of major U.S. banks and corporations that had made huge pre-war loans and investments in Japan. Morgan Bank had provided Japan with many loans, including one of $150 million to rebuild Tokyo after the Kanto earthquake, and the Japanese government had defaulted on repayment of all these loans at the time of Pearl Harbor. Many other U.S. corporations had major pre-war stakes in Japan in the form of loans and direct investments. At the end of 1941, American investment accounted for three-quarters of the total foreign capital in Japanese industry. The largest single direct investment, nearly half the total, was by General Electric, one of the Morgan extended family. GE held 16% of the paid-up capital of Tokyo Shibora Electric, a firm linked to the Mitsui Zaibatsu. Other large investments had been made by Associated Oil and Mitsubishi Petroleum, by Westinghouse in Mitsubishi Electric, by Owens Libby in Sumitomo, by American Can in Mitsui, and so on. After the war, these U.S. corporations were owed reparations, royalties, and loan payments totaling more than $1 billion. They were determined not only to recover their investments, but to resume their profitable business operations in Japan. If Japan's biggest conglomerates were broken up, this would impact directly on their American partners. If the directors and owners of these zaibatsu were condemned to death or to long prison terms, the new management might well argue that they were not responsible for debts incurred under a previous criminal military dictatorship. If efforts to introduce democracy to Japan miscarried and led to a socialist or communist takeover, past experience with Soviet Russia showed that such debts would never be honored. This new rationale was taking hold in Washington and being echoed in Tokyo thanks to careful orchestration. Japanese government spokesmen said that SCAP was prosecuting businessmen not because they'd committed war crimes or acquired their wealth by illegal means, but because they had been successful. Quote, "We find it difficult to understand how this can be democracy. The empire's key financial and industrial figures, the men we need most to provide a sound business development upon which real democracy must rest, are condemned without trial merely because they were businessmen," unquote. The old guard in the Diet, echoing Joe Gru, predicted chaos and confusion, unquote, and communist revolution in Japan if these purges went ahead. In Washington, a group known as the Japan Crowd encouraged these reversals of SCAP policy. Joe Gru was their spokesman, guarded by Herbert Hoover as well as by Morgan aide Thomas Lamont, who had raised a generation of investment bankers to share his view of China as a corrupt place and Japan as a nation of fiscal self-discipline. After the war, Gru retired from his post as Undersecretary of State and moved to Wall Street, where he became the leading lobbyist of the Japan Crowd. By 1947, America's Republican Party was in full resurgence. Democrats were on the defensive. SCAP reforms were being aborted, and all talk of purges and retribution in Japan was silenced. GRU and the Japan crowd prevailed because Mao's successes in China and communist challenges in Korea, Vietnam, Indonesia, and elsewhere alarmed even liberal politicians, persuading them of the need to build an iron triangle of Japan, Taiwan, and Korea. Conservative American business leaders were usually careful to denounce monopolies and cartels in principle, but they successfully fought off any effort to break up Japan's conglomerates in practice. GRU and his colleagues made all the right democratic noises about reforming post-war Japan, while working energetically behind the scenes to block all efforts at reform. These men believed that the best hope for the future Pacific economy lay in reviving pre-war trade patterns, with America again becoming Japan's biggest trading partner. Japan had the only massive industrial base in Asia. Once its financial elite were fully restored to positions of control, Japan would become an industrial bulwark against further expansion of communism in Asia. The time frame was urgent. GRU also became co-chairman of a new lobbying group, the American Council on Japan, or ACJ. The ACJ was a political action committee set up by wealthy American conservatives immediately after the war to lobby Washington and to fight the initiatives on reforming Japan that were being championed by liberals, whom the ACJ scathingly referred to as New Deal Democrats, unquote, and communist fellow travelers, unquote. The ACJ was backed by Newsweek, the magazine founded in 1937 by Averell Harriman and others. Harriman's brother was a Newsweek director. The magazine championed the Wall Street view of Japan's future. ACJ's chief organizers were Harry F. Kern, Newsweek's foreign editor, Compton Pakenham, the magazine's Tokyo bureau chief, and James Lee Kaufman, a New York lawyer who had taught at Tokyo University between 1913 and 1919 and had served as an attorney in Japan for General Electric, Standard Oil, Westinghouse, Ford, National Cash Register, Otis Elevator, and Dillon Reed. Kern was a personal friend of the Harrimans, and Pakenham had grown up in Japan and, as one critic put it, quote, looked upon most indicted war criminals in Tokyo as his childhood playmates, unquote. After the war, Kern and Kaufman were both given high honors by Hiroshito. By the way, that's Emperor Hiroshito, the Emperor of Japan. GRU's co-chairman at the ACJ was another member of the Hoover Circle and a former ambassador to Japan, William Castle. Descended from one of Hawaii's plantation-owning Grande families, Castle had been an undersecretary of state during Hoover's presidency. GRU's right-hand man at the ACJ was Japan-born career diplomat Eugene Dooman, who had worked with GRU at the State Department during the war. Their self-proclaimed mission was to correct SCAP excesses, unquote, to reverse America's early efforts to punish, reform, and democratize Japan. In the summer of 1947, Kaufman visited Tokyo on behalf of Dillon Reed and made a personal assessment of the Truman administration's secret plan for the breakup of the Zaibatsu. The secret FEC 230 documents were then leaked to Newsweek by Undersecretary of the Army William Draper, in civilian life a senior partner of Dillon Reed. In December 1947, while America was gearing up for its presidential election campaign, Newsweek began a series of articles denouncing SCAP 1. The magazine accused SCAP of running amok and exceeding its authority. SCAP was trying to impose, quote, an economic theory which has no counterpart anywhere else in the world. It is not communistic, but it is far to the left of anything tolerated in this country, unquote. Newsweek went on to warn American taxpayers that this plan posed grave dangers to their wallets, quote, Japan is costing the American taxpayers millions of dollars a year, unquote. Breaking up the Zaibatsu would weaken the Japanese economy to the point where the maintenance of Japan would become a continual charge on the American taxpayer, unquote. It was vital, Pakenham said, to get Japan back on track and to make it, quote, a fertile field of American capital, unquote. In the U.S. Congress, the attack was led by Republican Senator William F. Noland, a wealthy California newspaper publisher who charged that vital information about U.S. policy in Japan was being hidden from the American people. He said SCAP policy was contrary to American standards of decency and fair play and not in conformity with our own political, moral, or economic standards. Foreshadowing the witch hunts of Senator Joseph McCarthy, Noland insinuated that FEC 230 had been concocted by communists in the State Department. Herbert Hoover had earlier warned Bonner Fellers that the State Department was sending, quote, a bunch of communists, unquote, to Tokyo, along with some fellow travelers, unquote. At the time, MacArthur aide Fellers was very busy suborning General Tojo and other key witnesses. Hoover was living in an apartment at the Waldorf Astoria in New York City, where he met regularly with Gru, Kern, and the others. He encouraged them to attack SCAP while at the same time secretly giving advice to MacArthur and Fellers and passing questions to Hiroshito. During this whole period, Hoover continued to lead MacArthur to believe that he had a serious chance of being nominated as a Republican presidential candidate or at the very least, vice president. This made MacArthur acutely sensitive to Newsweek's charges that SCAP was pursuing goals that were virtually communistic. In a fury, he expelled Pakenham from Japan, then was obliged to backtrack and let him return under pressure from his Republican friends in New York City. When Senator Noland then made his inflammatory charges in the Senate, MacArthur became apoplectic with rage, but there was nothing he could do. While he could ignore the White House, the Pentagon, and the State Department, he could not offend the men who were to decide his presidential chances. Accordingly, MacArthur halted all further punitive moves by SCAP, weeded out the remaining liberals and New Dealers from its ranks, turned SCAP 1 into SCAP 2, and followed the prophylactic course dictated by those who held his future in their fists. The death blow to reform came soon afterward. In February 1948, the American government sent two Wall Street bankers to Japan to decide whether liberal reforms should go ahead or not. The outcome was predictable. The Draper-Johnston Commission, led by banker Percy Johnston and Undersecretary of the Army William Draper, spent 2 weeks in Japan, then announced its recommendations. Draper knew little about Japan, but as he was on leave from his position as a vice president of Dillon Reed, it was only natural that he was anxious to protect its investments and those of related firms. Earlier, he had made a name for himself by rescuing German industry from the excessive zeal, unquote, of U.S. occupation forces in Europe. Percy Johnston was chairman of New York's Chemical Bank, which had long-standing ties with Mitsui Bank. So this was like sending foxes to inventory the henhouse. What Japan really needed, they said, was not to be punished for waging a merciless war, but to be restored to economic power as quickly as possible. The Japanese themselves could not possibly have said it better. Of the original list of 325 Japanese companies that were to be reorganized, only 20 remained on the Draper-Johnston list. No Japanese banks were to be restructured. The ambitious American plan to reform Japan's economy and government was suffocated in the cradle in less than 3 years. As a precaution, the great Zaibatsu banks did change their names for a while. Mitsubishi Bank temporarily became Chiyoda Bank, Sumitomo Bank became Osaka Bank, Yasuda Bank became Fuji Bank, and so on. The boom brought about by the Korean War, 1950 through 1953, quickly returned them to profitability and made it possible to resurface their carefully hidden assets without attracting attention. Prime Minister Yoshida called the Korean War, quote, a gift from the gods, unquote. Next, we're going to examine how the Japanese Zaibatsu, the business partners of the powerful American corporations, Morgan Group firms in particular, were not only returned to power, but were able to draw on war reparations for damage to their own armaments factories, and how their American business partners also basically were able to appropriate many of the assets that were tendered for war reparations, returning to the Yamato dynasty. In the immediate post-war scramble for reparations, the Japanese Zaibatsu, including the wealthy families toward whom Edwin Pauly was so sympathetic, and who, like post-war Prime Minister Tanaka, for example, had profited enormously from the war, and hid their profits, submitted their own claims for compensation for wartime damage to their armaments factories. These claims came to more than $5 billion, and many were paid. Compare that to the $1 billion paid to victims. Instead of cash payments to conquered countries, Japan was ordered to send industrial equipment. Even these token reparations were suspended by Washington when the equipment was claimed as collateral for bonds issued before the war by American firms, including Morgan Bank and Dillon Reed, who were at the head of a long line of U.S. corporations with big pre-war investments in Japan. By the early 1950s, Japan owed Morgan nearly $600 million in unpaid interest, penalties, and principal just for the 1924 earthquake loan. This did not include other huge sums for other loans that Morgan and members of its extended family had made before 1940. In 1951, an official from Japan's Ministry of Finance arrived at Morgan headquarters at 23 Wall Street saying, quote, "I have come to honor my signature," unquote. At this time, no Japanese bureaucrat had the power to make any such statement. Japan was still an occupied country, and nothing of this sort could have been said without the explicit approval of General MacArthur. In any event, the official went on to say that Japan had not defaulted on a loan in 2,000 years. Refinancing and servicing was arranged through Smith Barney and Guarantee Trust. Smith Barney had already joined the Morgan family when it suffered financial reversals during the Depression, and Guarantee Trust had been a Morgan ward since the 1920s. Thus, Morgan not only benefited by getting its loans repaid, but by having its subsidiaries collect commissions for restructuring the same loans. In the end, there was nothing fair about the way Japan's acknowledged post-war resources were allocated. People who were physically the victims of Japanese brutality were completely upstaged by big corporations that commandeered all the money that had been made available. One of the ways that the status quo was preserved in Japan after the war was by seeing to it that the emperor basically was exonerated of all war guilt, and that the emperor and allied interests were then put right back in power. In order to do this, the various Japanese military officials and princes of the royal family who were willing to implicate the emperor in the considerable war guilt that he bore were either discredited or apparently liquidated. There were several ways they could alter the facts. For example, anyone who might testify against Hirohito either had to change his testimony or face persecution and ruin. When Fellers discovered something negative about Hirohito, he literally set about destroying the source. Naturally, Prince Conaway was intimately informed, and when Fellers heard what Conaway had to say about Hirohito's guilt, he denounced the prince as, quote, "a rat who's quite prepared to sell anyone to save himself," and even went so far as to call his master, the emperor, the major war criminal, unquote. Thereafter, Fellers, Bishop, and MacArthur took an intense dislike to Prince Conaway, and with no further justification, added his name to the list of war criminals to be prosecuted. One of the few statesmen who had tried to talk Hirohito into seeking an early peace, and who had earlier volunteered to go to Switzerland to arrange peace talks, Prince Conaway was now blackballed by the Americans and hounded to despair in a vicious campaign of backbiting and innuendo. He was informed falsely that his name had now been moved to the top of the list of war criminals, and that he faced imminent arrest and imprisonment. On December 16, 1945, he was found dead in his home. Most sources quote him saying he would not submit to the indignity of trial. The official ruling was suicide, but scholars Marion and Susie Harries, among others, believe that Prince Conaway was murdered. They offer compelling evidence against suicide. And skipping down, two of Prince Asaka's staff, who carried out his orders at the rape of Nanking, died suddenly of heart trouble, unquote, at the end of 1945, before the trials got underway. A similar fate befell at least one American diplomat who was opposed to the reinstitution of the status quo in Japan. The Seagraves write in the Amato Dynasty, "America's oligarchs had rescued Japan's oligarchs. Although it was absurd to see the Pacific War as only a minor historical aberration, they were intent upon restoring things in Japan as they were before the war." George Keenan said, We had purposely relieved our erstwhile opponents of every shred of responsibility of what was now to come, unquote. The elite simply tucked the bitter pill in their cheek to spit it out the moment the Americans were gone. Given a priceless opportunity, the American occupation had done little to change Japan. What was intended to be a victory of Western democracy over Japanese fascism became a struggle between American liberals and American conservatives, with many casualties. One of them was George Acheson, the senior State Department advisor in Japan. Although he was resigned to, quote, the short solution, unquote, he had his enemies more than he knew. Repeatedly, he and his liberal colleagues and friends were harassed by MacArthur's hardcore right-wingers, General Whitney, General Willoughby, and Colonel Bunker. Acheson had been friends with Terry Terasaki and his wife and daughter since 1941, when Terry had frantically tried to stop the attack on Pearl Harbor. In Tokyo after the war, Acheson saw a lot of the Terasakis and realizing how desperately poor they were, he took them packages of foods and other gifts from the embassy store and the U.S. Army post exchanges. Inevitably, U.S. military police or G2 agents would then appear, arrest Terry, and search his house for stolen American goods, unquote. This was the kind of harassment the MacArthur team was good at, a form of friendly fire, unquote. In August 1947, when MacArthur's inner circle was making the final turnabout from SCAP 1 to SCAP 2, George Acheson decided he had to go back to Washington personally to report to the Secretary of State and the White House what was afoot. He gathered several members of his staff together and set out by government plane across the Pacific, bound for Honolulu. After passing lonely Johnston Island, but well short of Hawaii, the plane that had been fully fueled mysteriously ran out of fuel and went down. One of the survivors said that as the plane fell, Acheson shrugged, shook his head sadly, and said, "It can't be helped," unquote. When news of the crash reached Terry Terasaki in Tokyo, he was stunned. In a daze, he went to the shore of Sagami Bay and, tears in his eyes, walked fully clothed into the sea to immerse himself for an hour with his friend Acheson and all the other victims of the war whose hopes had now died twice. Once, when they were trampled by the oligarchs of Japan, and then when they were trampled by the oligarchs of America.
That again from For the Record, program number 426, recorded on September 29th of the year 2003. Again, that material from the book The Yamato Dynasty by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave, a prequel, so to speak, to their remarkable, decisive volume called Gold Warriors, about which we have had so much to say in many programs that we have done in the past. Again, this show has been to illustrate how Japanese fascism, just like German fascism, was inextricably linked with the forces of transnational corporate maneuvering and globalization. These are not new things, so when we hear on the right, for example, Donald Trump talking about his facile solutions for alleviating the stress of globalization, I wouldn't place a lot of stock in that. Or, on the other hand, when we listen to Bernie Sanders also making similar promises, I think in many ways as vain as what Donald Trump has been promising, albeit somewhat more upbeat. Neither of them, as different as Trump and Bernie Sanders are in some ways, neither of them has really been, shall we say, wrong on specifics. Trump is essentially a contradictory ideological kaleidoscope, and what he says and what he means really changes from one minute to the next. And Bernie Sanders, although I agree with many of the goals he has articulated, has frankly waxed demagogic much of the time when talking about how he is going to do what he proposes to do. He bases it all on a prospective political revolution, which As the Beatles noted, you say you want a revolution, well, you know, and I'm not going to embarrass myself by singing more of the song, but I think to an extent the Police in another song had the rejoinder to that. There is no bloody revolution, not yet anyway. So again, as that old joke that said it's a good thing we didn't lose World War II, otherwise all of our officials would be named Schultz, Weinberger, and Kissinger, and everybody be driving Japanese and German cars. Well, reflect on fascism and globalization and transnational corporations. We have talked about that at great length with regard to Germany, not so much with regard to Japan. This will act as something of a compendium to correct the latter defect. This concludes For the Record program number 905. Globalization, transnational corporations, and Japanese fascism. This is being recorded on May 8th of 2016. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.